Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, well, more COVID-19 updates, of course, but we do get useful sales updates from Dollar Tree, as well as some updates from the produce industry on what is selling well around these times, around the times of panic buying, if you will. Perhaps the star of today's show, though, is Dan Hirsch, co-founder of Arizona-based Data Owl. He's our interview guest this week, and he'll be joining us to actually discuss sales trends surrounding dispensaries in the era of COVID-19. And this is interesting because it's a subsection of retail we don't often talk a lot about, but for the most part, they are all open, and some regulations have actually been relaxed surrounding dispensaries. So he's going to talk about those. He's going to talk about sales trends throughout the U.S., and he's going to talk about technology that dispensaries have been using for some time that might be instructive to other small retailers. It's a great interview. Make sure you stick around for that. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that's on Spotify, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Blueberry, Stitcher, you name it, we're on that platform. Additionally, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, both Instagram and Twitter. Before we get to Dollar Tree and Family Dollar, we wanted to give a bit of a status update on things that we're experiencing once again in the retail world, just a 30,000-foot overview of retail as it stands now. And I think, Leighton, we're starting to see some cracks in supply chains. One evidence of this fact is that Amazon out of a lot of products, and Amazon also beginning to prioritize products. So some products, for example, food storage systems, aren't even available for shipment until the end of April because they are prioritizing other products, which is kind of interesting. You would think in a pandemic, people aren't supposed to leave the house. Food storage systems would be one of those prioritized items, but Amazon has adjudicated them to not be prioritized items in this case. You're seeing the number of overall Prime items available shrink dramatically. And for Amazon, they're out of a lot of food and food staple products. For example, they're out of rice for the next 10 days or so, according to a lot of the Amazon product pages. They're out of a number of consumer staples. So you're starting to see chinks in the Amazon armor, so to speak, as their volumes go up. You're also seeing some delays in other areas. For example, Kroger's ClickList program, they're running about 2 to 3 days behind schedule in most markets. I know in Colorado where I'm at, they're about 2 to 3 days behind schedule in most places here. There are some markets, especially more rural markets in the U.S., where they're not running so far behind, but a lot of the major markets, they're beginning to run behind. And I know you've experienced some interesting facets with your recent retail visits in California, but also you traveled again for business, again for required work to the Midwest this week.
Yeah, that's right. I was in Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, just to name a few. And then obviously traveling around my now home state of California. So I've been really able to see a number of different retailers, see how they're operating, see some of the pros and cons of the current landscape. And I would have to say that I am impressed by a number of retailers that have remained open. And by impressed, I mean just their normal operating procedures and how they've changed and how they're accommodating the needs of worried customers amid this coronavirus. So first, I would like to say that dollar stores, which we'll talk about actually during this episode with Dollar Tree and Family Dollar, dollar stores are doing quite well. Traffic is trending up in a lot of cases. I will go into the stores themselves. I will ask store employees or store management, how are those stores performing and how they're performing versus last year? And obviously sales have been up. Sales have been up in a number of categories, like consumer goods, paper products being in there, and then also grocery, as one can imagine. Half of their shelves are empty. People are still buying those essential things or things that they deem essential to take home and store for a period of time. But I would also like to say that grocery stores are still very, very busy. And this is one of the things that we've discussed actually over the last two podcasts, Trent. Is it going to wane? Because everybody stocked up initially. There was this big push to load up your carts full of groceries for the next couple of months or however long people presume this to last. But now you're seeing that people are still going into grocery stores and still buying a lot of those same kinds of goods. So the store shelves are actually still empty, and you still have a full employee base in each of these stores that are working to backfill those shelves and to help those customers out when needed. But lastly, I will say that it is very interesting. I went to an Ace Hardware. It was packed full of customers, packed full of employees, people getting things done in terms of their housework, and they're also getting things like disinfectants because they, of course, still stock those just as your normal grocery store or Walmart would. And talking to the employees at this particular location, this, again, Ace Hardware, they were very optimistic about the sales and the sales forecast in the coming months. And they said that their hours aren't going to be changing much and that they actually project a lot more people coming in over the next few weeks. And then also Lowe's Home Improvement, in that same vein, in that same space, they have been, I've gone into a couple locations, they've been packed as well. You just see from sort of the outset there, the parking lots have been full. And again, employees are very, very excited about the prospect of all of those sales coming in. And by the way, still being able to work. Some are actually very thankful that they still have a job and still have been able to keep more or less the same amount of hours that they were working just a couple of months ago before this coronavirus hit.
You mentioned Ace Hardware. One of the things that I did want to bring up, our interview guest Dan Hirsch, he and I were talking kind of after the interview, and he said Ace Hardware in particular, of the retailers that he's gone to since this kind of started, and Ace is large in Arizona where he's based out of, there are Aces just about on every street corner, it seems, there. But he mentioned that in many cases, Ace stores have it to where they've got 6 feet lines delineated in the checkout line. So they'll have stripes of tape exactly 6 feet apart. When one customer finishes checking out, the cashier will hold the next customer at that back 6 foot line, disinfect everything that customer A touched, and then bring customer B up into the line. And he said it was working like clockwork, like a well-oiled machine. And you kind of wonder if more retailers aren't going to adopt a method like that. But I know you and I were talking before the podcast, and Ace is, of course, big in California, big in many areas in the Midwest that you were visiting, and we've both been impressed by their overall reaction. Now, I haven't actually been to an Ace since this started. In fact, as I've mentioned, more out of obligation than anything, practicing social distancing. But again, Ace stores here, they've been very well received. Ace has a large distribution center near where I'm at, and it looks like it's going to shape up to be a pretty good month for Ace, not only on the PR front, but also in terms of sales and bringing in those sales. Lowe's, Home Depot, as we've mentioned time and again, they seem to be very busy as well. Well, we get an update, speaking of businesses that are busy, from Dollar Tree and Family Dollar. There are interesting numbers here from each. The update came out last week as Dollar Tree, as a company, very transparent about the trends they're seeing in both of their business divisions, Layton.
Both Dollar Tree and Family Dollar have been classified as essential retail, so in most circumstances, they are open close to regular hours. They did take the measure of modifying store hours to close all stores by 8 p.m. back on March 18th, and you'll see that in several markets, and they're sticking to that. And in some markets, they have limited the number of people who can be in the stores at a time, in some cases, as low as 15 to 20 people at a time. A number of markets are actually delineating between stores the size of Family Dollar and Dollar General and other retailers, thus shrinking the amount of customers the stores may have otherwise seen, although we have yet to note that it would have had a substantial impact. And as we dig through the numbers here, Trent, we knew the sales would be up given their initiatives to hire 25,000 individuals for their stores and distribution centers. Same store sales from March 1st through March 29th were up 7.1% for Dollar Tree and a whopping 14.4% for Family Dollar. Obviously, the coronavirus related buying, they are seeing an unprecedented boost for Family Dollar. However, what stood out to us is how the sales have changed throughout the course of the month. Sales spiked around the middle of March, which is where sales spiked for most retailers as it became apparent stay-at-home orders would be issued in a number of states. However, in the 7 days leading up to March 29th, sales were up 8.8% at Family Dollar, not quite the mid-March surge, but still very significant. at the same time. Same store sales were actually down 19.4% at Dollar Tree, a massive fall off from earlier in the month. The strongest categories for the enterprise as a whole were exactly what one might actually think during this time. The list starts with cleaning supplies and sanitizer, of course, and of course, paper goods, paper towels, toilet paper, that kind of thing. From there, household products, food, and over-the-counter medicine are the next in-demand categories. However, these categories, especially paper goods, food, and over-the-counter medicine, that carry lesser margins than the rest of their merchandise mix, so you can expect maybe not as much of a bolster on the bottom line. One can also assume that they are seeing flagging sales in seasonal, which has been a crucial driver of margin for Dollar Tree in particular, especially around this time of year as we approach Easter. This will likely mean a slew of markdowns or packaway in seasonal, since the majority of their buying took place well in advance of all of this, and you can actually see that in their back rooms. Back rooms are full of seasonal goods. Of course, markdowns equals margin hits as well, so not good for the bottom line. But it is because of this margin concern that the company leadership does not expect the bottom line to be all that stellar for the first quarter overall. While they declined to give specific guidance, and in fact withdrew their first quarter guidance, they did not lower margin item sales, the huge amount of them, as a big reason why they may struggle somewhat with cost of goods sold, and as such, cost of goods sold may rise. Additionally, their investments in staff, including the new hiring of new staff and onboarding and bonuses to present staff, will further cut into the bottom line. Distribution costs also have been on the rise prior to this. And while the price of fuel is extremely low, as it is in a number of markets, they are having to pay workers extra and likely overtime to fulfill all of this demand. If that weren't enough, there is a documented shortage of drivers, something we'll discuss a little bit later on this podcast, actually. All of this led to their announcement in the release that they would not be repurchasing shares in the short term, or at least they did not expect to do so, and I would not expect them to do so either, Trent.
And it's interesting because for as positive as the sales numbers were on this press release, there was a lot of negative or at least tempering of expectations from management for Dollar Tree. The company noted, in fact, that it's basically becoming impossible to plan in certain areas because the reaction of local and state governments, and of course you're talking about a retailer here that has a massive widespread footprint around the country, the reaction of local and state governments has been very much mixed because of the uncertainty surrounding stay-at-home or shelter-in-place regulations. The company is having a lot of difficulty planning staffing appropriately, particularly at Dollar Tree, because Dollar Tree, you think about it, kind of less top of mind for essentials there. If that weren't enough, uncertainty of supply is haunting them like it is every other essential retailer, but especially on the Family Dollar side, they do have the benefit of having strong relationships with the larger brands, which is something that a number of local outlets, and we should mention companies like Amazon, who are a little bit newer to this space, do not seem to have. One other thing of note in the press release is that the company is putting some of their initiatives to build out pods or sections in their stores on hold, at least for now, as well as some of their renovation expectations and initiatives for Family Dollar. We kind of assumed this would be the case even prior to the press release. I think it kind of goes without saying that a lot of these initiatives for a lot of retailers throughout the country are going to be put on hold. Not only is it disrupting regular store operations, but you're also bringing workers in to kind of work on the remodels. Oftentimes these are done by traveling remodel teams. Travel, of course, is limited, so there's a lot of external reasons why this wouldn't be possible, even if you just wanted to keep all hands on deck and stores stocked and functional during this time. So as such, the massive slate of Family Dollar H2 renovations that we kind of talked about a couple of months ago will not be happening on the projected schedule for fiscal 2020. Additionally, they said that their Dollar Tree snack zone buildouts will be suspended for now. This is likely as much a result of lack of product more than anything. The snack zone buildouts don't require that much in terms of construction, but lacking that product might be a significant headwind there. And no word regarding the Dollar Tree Plus initiatives in this release, although it wouldn't surprise us at all to see them try to work this in where possible, again, where it's possible to do so without interrupting regular store operations. because this might help the buyers fill shelves. If they have leverage to go to a higher price point because they know they can charge $2 for a product, they might be able to do so. Even though there are some recessionary spending habits expected in the next few months, because right now, for a lot of products, demand outstrips supply. We're not talking about discretionary products here, but those household essentials that Dollar Tree often stocks their shelves with, buyers on the Dollar Tree side may have a rough few months ahead in some categories because those essentials and prices on those essentials are going up. Overall, I think our takeaway, and we kind of talked about this over the last couple of weeks, Leighton had visited a few Family Dollars, especially as we head into April, Family Dollar is likely the better positioned of the two stores in the short term. They have a massive benefit, as does Dollar General, that in many markets, they're the only game in town for household essentials and paper products. If you go into a lot of rural areas, you will see either a Family Dollar or Dollar General as being the only store in that town. And with a lot of small grocery stores not having the clout with the big national brands and the big national suppliers that those two companies have, they're kind of in the catbird seat as far as those markets are concerned. So their small market stores may see the greatest benefit, but I also think stores that are well positioned in urban areas, like, for example, those near apartment complexes or those that are a fair distance from the nearest Walmart or Kroger or Albertsons or what have you, are going to see a bit of a benefit as well. However, one thing we are beginning to see is that lack of Dollar Tree's positioning in the minds of consumers as a reliable retailer of essential goods. Leighton talked about how recently their sales are actually down year over year. And, you know, if you think about, if you've been to a Dollar Tree, in the best of times, Dollar Tree's shelves run bare. So it's only natural that customers are choosing to go elsewhere during these times of panic buying and hard-to-find household essentials. If you're going to make one trip out of your house for these things, you don't want to go someplace where you don't know if you're going to be able to find the product. And Dollar Tree, like I mentioned, for as many benefits as they bring to the consumer and for that low price point, a lot of times they do run out of products. They have rotational products as well. So you can't necessarily count on them for a lot of those household essentials if you're that consumer making that one trip. However, that being said, I think both stores stand to benefit, especially Dollar Tree, if there is a prolonged economic downturn of any sort, and if, as we've seen, millions remain jobless. If this lingers on for any length of time, these two stores stand to benefit. And once stock for them, in-store stock, is well positioned again, Dollar Tree will definitely be in a spot to capitalize on share of wallet for those who don't have as much to spend. They were in the same position, actually, when you look back to 2008. And in fact, the period of time following the Great Recession saw tremendous growth at Dollar Tree as consumers turned to them first because they had less money to spend, and then they became habitual shoppers there. Could this happen again in 2021 with a new spate of shoppers? Or will the economic recovery and the recovery from coronavirus be quicker than most anticipate? That's obviously a big question, but for right now, the big goal for both of these stores is just to keep stores open and keep things in stock. Well, that'll do it for the first story here on the Retail Focus podcast. Coming up once again, our interview with Dan Hirsch, who is the co-founder of Arizona-based Data Owl. We're going to talk to him about how coronavirus and worries surrounding COVID-19 have affected dispensaries and affected this subsection of retail. We'll also talk to him a little bit about what other areas of retail might be able to glean from dispensaries during this time. There are endless numbers of sales trends we're seeing around COVID-19, particularly as retailers begin to parse out numbers from March, as we discussed in last week's show. But one of the more intriguing retail sectors in all of this is kind of that loosely grouped set of liquor stores and dispensaries as customers change how they are buying based around macro-level developments. Joining us to discuss these trends as they relate to dispensaries is Dan Hirsch. He's the co-founder of Arizona-based Data Owl, whose data solutions help to power effective operations of dispensaries throughout the country. Coming up in a future show, we'll actually talk to a general manager of one such dispensary using these products. But Dan, thank you so much for taking the time and welcome to the podcast today.
Thanks, Trent. Pleasure to be here. My partner and I started in late 2016. So a little bit about Data Owl, just so you kind of know what we do. We're a technology or a SaaS company providing tools to help retail dispensaries enhance their operations, market to and retain their existing customers, and do things like, which in this moment in time, of course, is critical, enable online pre-orders. We operate in 24 states as well as Jamaica and Puerto Rico. So we have a decent view of overall of what's happening to this industry and how COVID-19 is affecting each of our customers in these states.
So as you mentioned, 24 states, but that's going to give you a lot of data with which to work. But first, what are some of the trends that you've seen so far in terms of how states are treating this type of retail, whether it's leaving dispensaries open or restricting them maybe to curbside or closing them altogether?
Absolutely. So, you know, the initial answer would be overall in most states, it's been deemed an essential service. So there's been some variance in how it's been handled, but as a whole, dispensaries are generally open. There are indeed restrictions of various kinds being put on them, ranging from limiting number of people coming inside the dispensary or curbside only pickup. They're fast tracking delivery in many markets where they've been kind of slow moving towards that. So if you've been reading kind of the other industry stuff being published, really they've focused on this huge drop off, right? Oh my God, the dispensaries aren't going to have any business. And what they did is they used as examples, they're using Nevada and Colorado. Well, obviously, Nevada and Colorado, if you're looking at March in the middle of this versus either March last year in Colorado's case, or even January, February, these are both markets where tourism is critical to the cannabis trade. And so in markets where it isn't as heavily driven by tourism, right? You know, obviously Colorado ski season, spring break are a big deal. And in Nevada, of course, you know, they closed all the casinos and hotels on the 18th. So Nevada fell off a cliff. So the doom and gloom isn't quite the same in this space. The data is actually continuing to show that consumption is stabilized similar levels. And actually the last couple of days is starting to look like alcohol consumption. It's actually going up. You know, and I know, of course, data always has shown that alcohol, tobacco, cannabis is going to be similar, I suspect. You know, they're sort of, quote, recession proof, if you will. And we're certainly seeing some of the markets, digital marketing wasn't considered okay. They've loosened those restrictions to allow online pre-orders because, again, they recognize people need access to these products.
And to that end, we'll talk about the data here in a second, but I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the products. You know, you and your team have been working nonstop over the last several weeks to try and find solutions for these dispensaries, especially, as you mentioned, because many of them maybe couldn't accommodate digital sales simply because of laws or restrictions or regulations. What are some of the tools that these dispensaries are finding most effective at this point?
Of course, the number one is e-commerce, you know, and again, this is a modified e-commerce in the sense that payment, you know, there's restrictions on payment in the cannabis industry, can't use credit cards and things like that, but pre-ordering and making their inventory available so customers can place orders online is the number one need. And we have calls daily right now saying, how fast can you get us up and operational on that side of the business? In addition, there's a number of other things that are important. So one of the major tools that our customers use with us is text messaging to keep their existing customers informed of what products they have available, specials and offers, things of that nature. And that's critically important now because customers are looking for products. Retaining your customers in this market is very important. And our tools use data to allow the dispensaries to personalize or target these promotions and offers and things very specifically based on the products the customers are actually buying. One other piece of technology that's sort of new that we had to work on is we've always had a check-in, if you will, like a tool to manage the lobby. So that when they have a bunch of customers in the lobby waiting for their turn at the dispensary, which is very typical, especially on busy days like Friday and Saturday, that's an industry where, you know, Friday payday, Saturday, people will go to dispensaries typically more than they do on, say, a Monday or a Tuesday. We modified that tool to allow it to have customers check in from the parking lot. And so it really simplifies or limits, it gives them control, frankly, of how many people, if they're having them come in to pick up, how many come in at a time. They can tell them, it's your turn, come on in one at a time, and really manage that flow.
Now, Dan, you mentioned the habits surrounding weekend purchasing. So as you mentioned, Friday payday, people are going to these type of retailers on Saturday. But I think one of the more interesting findings in the data that you came out with, and you posted an interesting video on LinkedIn about some of the data that you're seeing so far, is that customers seem to be changing their habits as far as when they buy or the day of the week that they buy. What are you seeing around this, and what do you feel like are some potential reasons we're seeing this?
That's a great question. So we definitely are seeing, I'll call a flattening of or a redistribution of sales. So historically, what we've seen over the years is consumers have a set amount of money they spend on cannabis products every month. So we really work with our customers to try and get the maximum share of their customers' wallet. So they're not shopping at two or three dispensaries. They're loyal to, you know, a particular dispensary. Similarly, now what we're seeing is where the customers were shopping much greater percentage of total sales on a Friday and a Saturday, it's really spreading out much more evenly across the week. And so we've seen, if you will, a decline in the percent of sales represented by Friday and Saturday, and a dramatic increase in the percent of sales represented on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I suspect, and again, this is of course not something we can validate specifically yet, but I suspect probably the big reason is with so many people at home, 7 days a week now because of various quarantine or state requirements, et cetera, we're seeing people shop on various days a week when it's convenient for them. So we've seen a redistribution of day-a-week sales.
Now, one of the other things that I found more interesting, and this actually seems to dovetail with what we're seeing in other areas of retail as well, not just dispensaries, are massive changes in transactions and ticket value. So we're seeing kind of an inverse relationship there. What are some of the numbers that you're seeing around transactions and ticket value?
So the way we looked at all the data is we sort of looked at before COVID-19. So we looked at the average activity on days of the week, Monday through Sunday for January and February. And we did the same thing looking at transactions and ticket value, total revenue, to sort of see what the change is. And after what we sort of see was the surge, if you will, and there was a big ramp up in the first part of March, and it really continued through around March, call it, 20th, 21st. And so we treat it as the week of March 24th through March 30th as the first view of a normalized window. And in that window, what we really saw was a stabilization of ticket values, average purchase per transaction, up in the 30-35% over historic norms, and a corresponding drop in the number of transactions per day, every day, roughly in that same 30-40% range, with a little bit of variance, as I said, with that redistribution of, say, some of the Saturday shopping or Friday shopping now happening on Mondays. And it's really quite consistent in every state, regardless of whether or not they've seen an aggregate decline in sales in this sort of first week of, quote, new normal, if you will.
So we've talked about a lot of this data, and we talked briefly about some of the technological solutions that your team is putting into place for the dispensaries that you work with. But I'm kind of curious, just on a general level, what can retailers do, knowing a little bit of this data now that things are normalizing as we head into April, normalizing at least under COVID-19? What are some things that they can do to change or adjust the way in which they operate, or maybe even their marketing messaging?
So there's a few things that we really think matter right now. So one is, of course, I think general deal shopping is, you know, going to continue, but I suspect we're going to see, and we're kind of drilling into this, some price pressures. So as people feel like their wallets are, if you will, thinner, they're likely to trade down in product type. So, you know, you might have bought a premium product before, you're going to buy a lower end product. So we suspect there will be need for inventory that is on the, I'll say the more, you know, in traditional retail, we'd call it maybe, you know, they're trading from brand products to plain wrap. We suspect we're going to see that. We think the product mix is going to shift a bit since people are concerned about their lung health more. That consumption of things like edibles and drinkables is likely to continue an upward trend and a relative share versus the smokable products. So I think there's some product mix decisions to make. I think how they approach promotions, knowing customers are shopping 7 days of the week, will be a bit different. And then I really think crucial, and we also do offer this tool, loyalty, really refining how you're working your loyalty program, because it's going to be critical to keep your customers shopping with you. Since they're shopping less frequently, you want to make sure that one time they went out that week to go to a dispensary and pick up their order or order it online and have it delivered to their house, it's with you. And so you're really going to want to target them in a very specific way based on here is the products Trent likes to buy. We're going to make him offers specific to him on the products he likes to buy, and make sure that's front and center to him. So personalization of your offers is going to be critical, tied to loyalty incentives to make sure they come in. And so it might be discount less across the board and instead make targeted offers to your existing customers around the products that you know that they're purchasing. Our tools automate that process and give them incremental reward value through their loyalty program for buying those products.
So those are interesting things that you mentioned, especially in terms of moving product, how people may be going more towards edibles or more towards, as you mentioned, the plain wrap products. So I wanted to ask you this, just in terms of the industry as a whole, obviously we're seeing supply chain interruptions in other areas, knowing that there is going to be potentially increased demand for edibles, potentially increased demand for those plain wrap type products. How's the supply chain looking overall on the dispensary front?
So it's very market specific. So there's markets like Oregon that have historically had excess product. And so markets like that at the moment, you know, product is still readily available. There are other newer markets where there are already supply chain challenges. Illinois is a good example, right? They added recreational sales in January of this year. And so like most markets, when they instantly add recreational, demand surges dramatically, there's inadequate supply. So it really varies market to market, frankly. And the smart product producers are going to shift some of their resources to delivering, I suspect, some of these sort of greater volumes of lower end products, greater volumes of products maybe that are not smoked or inhaled.
So I wanted to kind of end on this, and this is an item that we brought up last show just in terms of data in general. As someone that analyzes data on a regular basis, going forward, once we put the pandemic and the associated consumer trends maybe a little bit behind us, you know, these months, March, April, they're going to leave us with some maybe anomalous trends, one would think. So what, as you look ahead 2-3 years down the road, might be able to be gleaned from this data that's being produced during this time? And also, because you spend so much time in this particular subsection of retail, do you feel like any of the consumer trends we're seeing now are going to have lasting impacts down the road?
So I think there are a few. I do think the shift to e-commerce or this pre-order, you know, how that evolves, that's going to continue. That's obviously a trend we've seen in many other retail sectors, as you know. That will really stick this as the industry's been forced to rapidly move in that direction. I think that's definitely going to be the case. I think that the importance of brands in this industry will continue to grow, at least for the foreseeable future. In an environment like this, the established brands are in a good place because they can sort of firm up their foothold, because new brands have a much harder time entering right now, since traditionally in this industry, a lot of normal advertising channels aren't as available. So critical to product companies was getting shelf space into this physical dispensary and introducing products that way through, you know, on-site promotions and things of that nature. And they're really going to have to evolve with that and create tactics to collaborate with the dispensaries to replicate some of that in the digital environment. And I think that trend will also continue.
So we asked you about the future of dispensaries here over the next couple of years. What's next on the horizon? Without giving away any company secrets for Data Owl, what are some things that you're working on, not only for, you know, these times with the COVID-19 and the impacts from that going on, but once the industry kind of gets out of that?
One of the areas we're focusing on is how to help connect the brands and the retailers in new and more efficient ways, to give the brands and the retailers better tools to collaborate and drive, of course, in the end, products into the hands of the consumers that they're looking for.
Once again, Dan Hirsch, the co-founder of Arizona-based Data Owl. It's great to talk to someone that's also in the Mountain West, for one, but it was great to have you on the podcast, and hopefully we can reconnect after all this is through.
It was a pleasure, Trent. I enjoyed being here, and stay well, stay healthy, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Well, once again, we thank Dan for joining us. I appreciate him taking his time. It's been a very busy couple of weeks for he and the team at Data Owl. And coming up this next week, as I kind of prefaced in the interview, we're going to talk to a manager of one of the stores that uses some of the Data Owl products, just about what she is seeing kind of on the ground with the retail trends surrounding COVID-19 and coronavirus. So interesting, as he mentioned, we very much think it's the case as well, where anything in terms of cannabis, anything in terms of tobacco, liquor, those are kind of recession proof because people sometimes turn to those products during these times. So you may still see demand high in those areas. What are those stores doing to capitalize on that high demand? Well, speaking of high demand, despite product demand being high, the grocery supply chain is now beginning to show cracks, Leighton. And the most obvious evidence of this is in the dairy industry. There's an in-depth article this week from Reuters that suggested dairy farmers were actually being told by cooperatives to dump milk. And this comes amidst a general shortage in retail stores. This sounds like a lose-lose-lose situation.
A very interesting dynamic playing out here with this dairy situation. The issue in the dairy industry is actually several-fold, as you kind of indicated in the intro there. First, the milk is ultimately perishable, as everybody knows. While some of the product is dried or canned, of course, you can have dried milk and find it at Costco, but that makes up so little, such a small portion of the overall milk sales and the overall demand for milk. Second, distribution issues are cropping up, and this is a big one, Trent, as cows are generally producing milk at the same rate they were at this time a year ago. There are fewer drivers to deliver milk to processing facilities, and in some cases onto bottlers and packagers due to virus fears. So if you think about that, Trent, production is the same as it's been, but people can't deliver that product. So that's going to create a supply chain problem in and of itself. Third, a decent portion of milk went directly to other food producers as value-add food producers and restaurants, both domestically and abroad. Because milk bottling for retail cannot keep up with demand, there is a bottleneck in the supply chain. Retail bottlers have more milk than they can even handle, in essence. And finally, fourth, manufacturers of value-add dairy products, such as, of course, cheese and yogurt, cannot scale quickly and effectively to take advantage of both supply and demand. And so this results in an inability to take advantage of what would ordinarily be lower prices on the wholesale market. All of this adds up to dairy cooperatives such as Dairy Farmers of America telling dairy farmers to basically dump some or all of the milk that they produce. The farmer in this Reuters article that Trent pointed out, Jason Liedl, dumped around 15,000 gallons, in fact, of milk last week alone. Another cooperative, Foremost Farms USA, told farmers that it is time to consider culling their herds, basically selling off underproducing cattle. So the dumping is going on while panic buying has led to the first increase in consumption of milk in several years. And this is something that we've actually talked about on the podcast in previous years. We've been podcasting for a while, Trent. But overall, milk sales have waned and things like almond milk and cashew milk have risen as not complementary goods, but competitive goods. So Nielsen data suggests that retail milk sales were actually up over this period of time, 53%. For the week ending March 21st, butter sales were also up 127%, and cheese sales were also up, as you can imagine, up 84%. And in any panic buying atmosphere, you'll see an increase in prices as well. So for the same week, Nielsen said that the average retail price of milk was up double digits, 11.2%. However, the dairy industry is attempting to keep from forced dumping, and this is obviously something that's good because it's not good to say that certain farmers are dumping tens of thousands of gallons of milk per week. That is not what you would like to see in this particular market. But Dean's Foods, who we really discussed on the podcast, was struggling mightily prior to the panic buying And they've extended hours at their processing plants and is offering higher sign-on bonuses as well for drivers with dairy experience. Perhaps the major underlying issue here, beyond finding workers, which is a difficulty even as millions are jobless right now, is the reallocation of product away from restaurants and to grocery stores. This is not just a problem in the dairy industry, although it was noted in the Reuters article that this is a severe issue for value-added products like cheese. The reality is packaging for food service uses is a lot different from packaging for retail stores, where the quantity might be 10 pounds for a bag of shredded cheese. You would rarely see bags larger than 5 pounds, even in a warehouse club. This is similar to the produce industry, where packers are now having to rush to change packaging on, say, onions from a 25-pound bag to a typical retail 3-pound bag. All of this while 25-pound bags are already, by the way, in the supply chain, going unused or just sitting in wait. However, there are certain trends, Trent, we are seeing in fresh foods, particularly produce as well.
And yeah, we're going to pivot here to talk a little bit about the supply chain and what we're seeing in produce, not only what people are buying, but how people are buying. And the reason I at least wanted to bring this up is because it's become nearly impossible to find onions and potatoes near me in Colorado, despite the fact that Colorado, in theory, is one of the largest producing states of both of those in the country. And we kind of wondered how this was affecting the rest of the produce aisle. And aside from panic buying surrounding produce that's less perishable, like potatoes and onions and some of the frozen foods as well, more coronavirus-related trends are developing in how people buy produce. For example, Stemilk growers in Washington, you've probably seen their branding on a lot of prepackaged products or packaging for products like, for example, cherries. They market a number of fresh food products, though. And they said this past week they're seeing more demand for pre-bagged apples than they've ever seen. In fact, we've seen just generally over the last 2 to 3 years, packers shift from kind of the potato bags, if you will, the same bags that potatoes would come in for apples, to what are called in the industry pouch bags. So you go into a grocery store now and you see a little bit different marketing as far as the bags that apples are being sold in. The pouch bags are seen as a little bit more approachable, similar to what you see grapes and cherries often in there. By the way, shout out to the publication Produce Retailer for keeping us up on these trends. We do love to talk about retail produce merchandising, and this is a merchandising trend that's been kind of changing over the last 2 to 3 years, but these pouch bags turned out to be a strong pivot for coronavirus buying habits, though companies like Stemilk couldn't have known that certainly when the shift started happening a few years ago. Stemilk's senior marketing manager, Brianna Shales, was quoted this week as saying that the company is seeing demand in these pouch bags over bulk apples during the last month. Now, this is credited in part to people buying more at a given time, but also credited to the idea that people, when they go to stores, are increasingly seeking to grab and go without doing so much analyzing of product quality. You know, they're not walking up to that bulk bin of apples, looking over the apples and figuring out which ones will work best for them because they want to get in and get out as a result of those virus fears. You're even seeing people kind of like ducking out of the way of other people in grocery stores. You're seeing people very, very adamant about keeping that 6-foot distance. Well, again, bulk apples don't really work that well in that sense, but the prepackaged apples do. And additionally, these pouch bags are also convenient for major retailers that have online ordering platforms. You look at a retailer like Kroger with ClickList, it's a lot easier for them to just say, hey, you can buy a 3-pound bag of Fuji apples than it is to say, hey, you can buy Fuji apples by the pound and we'll select them for you. So it's a little bit easier on the online sense. And this doesn't appear to be a trend only with apples, but Stemilk's noticing this with pears as well. And actually, one thing Stemilk said this last week is they feel like the prepackaged pears versus the bulk pears, at least over the last couple of weeks, has given people an entry into the pear marketplace because pears, they are refrigerated, they will last a little bit longer. So they're seeing more people actually look towards pears than maybe previously would have been the case. Now, in general, trends surrounding produce sales for the week ending March 22nd certainly support the idea of panic buying and produce. Steve Lutz, who's the Senior Vice President of Insights and Innovation for Category Partners, told the Packers retail editor and former podcast guest Ashley Nickel this week that onions and potatoes did see the biggest jump. But one of the other things that he said was that you're seeing a lot of activity on social media surrounding raw goods. So, for example, he cited data from Pinterest where you're seeing a lot more recipes out there, these recipes using a lot more fresh fruits and vegetables. This is parlaying itself into a little bit more demand. Now, one of the things that I think we're just generally kind of concerned about is what's going to happen with greens, because greens are packed and taken to market so quickly, similar to strawberries. Right now, it's kind of strawberry season in several parts of the country, but greens are taken to the market so quickly that you're having issues coming up with workers to pick the greens, first of all, because there are transportation issues there. And then you're also maybe not seeing traffic surrounding that which isn't perishable as much as before. But still, again, you're seeing traffic on social media going towards recipes, especially on Pinterest. You're seeing traffic on Pinterest really increasing surrounding recipes with fresh fruits and vegetables. And part of that is because, again, people are eating at home three meals a day instead of 1 to 2 meals a day now. One other thing that Lutz did mention is that we don't really know what the new normal is as far as produce sales is concerned. But one thing he did expect is to see some recessionary buying habits. Same buying habits that were mentioned in the interview earlier with Dan at Data Owl coming through in the produce industry. So you're likely to see people taking a look at some of the less premium items, some of the value priced items. You look at when things kind of return back to normal in terms of stock. You look at bulk potatoes, you look at bulk onions, you look at a lot of the bulk foods that are maybe a little bit less expensive, people going back to less expensive varieties of apples, maybe people not selecting organics as much as well, because if there's any kind of price difference there, again, if you have less in your wallet, you're going to be making the cheaper pick typically. One thing we've seen over the last 5 to 6 years in a time of relative economic stability is that you're seeing a lot more people go towards organics, spend the extra $1 to $2 on the organic product. Maybe you don't see that quite as much coming out of this, depending on how long-lasting the economic ramifications of this are. And again, we don't know that just yet. It could be that somehow something comes along to make the recovery very quick. It could be that the recovery will be drawn out over several years. If the latter part is the case, it's going to be up to the produce industry to kind of meet people where they're at, give them more value products, but also knowing that their idea surrounding the produce section may have been reshaped by this entire experience. So a lot of things going on as far as the produce industry is concerned, but the dairy industry as well. The dairy industry, they're seeing those short-term problems, but again, same question. Now that more people are turning towards milk and eggs and the like, do you see demand for that remain high coming out of the stay-at-home orders? A lot to be decided in the future.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at the story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And Leighton, you've got some labor issues that you're kind of keeping an eye on right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of articles circulating both on our social media and just on the internet in general. And a lot of them have to do with employees not being that happy right now, given the current atmosphere within the retail industry, particularly in distribution. And when you think distribution and retail, you tend to think Amazon. And that's what my primary focus is going to be for this looking ahead. And that a lot of people are trying to unionize and they're trying to organize their workforce in a lot of these distribution centers around the country. There was a proposed strike in New York, and now in Chicago, it looks like several days now where Amazon employees have organized a strike outside the building there. And honestly, Trent, this is very interesting because there's obviously, just like with anything, there's different ways you can look at this circumstance. But the workers at this Amazon facility in Chicago, in the Chicago area, are essentially on what they call a safety strike. So it's not all of the employees. There is not a complete walkout, as a lot of people may portray this to be. But it is simply a number of workers saying that Amazon needs to shut down facilities for the next 2 weeks and pay them full pay. And then also, if they get sick from coronavirus, pay them for the hospital bills, and then also their family, their immediate family, if they too get infected with coronavirus. And they're asking for a couple other things as well, like a safe, clean work environment, which of course is what we would hope for all Amazon or any retail facility, any distribution facility out there. And I think this is interesting, Trent, because right now you do have a number of people unemployed, several million people, in fact, unemployed, and that claim they would love to be working at a job right now. This is all also very interesting in that Amazon has done a few things and done so in a transparent way over the last few weeks, in that they have been cleaning facilities. They have been telling a lot of workers to go home where there is a potential threat. And then additionally, you have things that are more maybe on the macro level over the past few months, where you see Amazon is increasing pay. They're giving out bonuses. And so you have a lot of workers that are attracted to the prospect of working for an Amazon distribution facility, where maybe they were unemployed previously and now they'll get maybe $15 or $20 an hour to then get a job where you can get maybe 30 plus hours a week. So a very different thing now, a very different dynamic is actually playing out, because those very same workers, a lot of them are saying that Amazon should actually just send them home with really full pay and really to try to help the spread of this virus. But it is an interesting time, because a retailer such as Amazon is viewed in many areas as essential business. So they're distributing food and other things like paper products that people are really needing. And a lot of times you're still seeing lag times for some of these items, because they are prioritizing, Amazon is, what they ship out and when. So for instance, I bought a few items off of Amazon in this last week. They are non-essential items, but they're slated to be delivered to where I live in about 3 to 4 weeks. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on there at Amazon. My question is, if they shut everything down, Trent, and this is why it's my looking ahead, if they give in to kind of this demand to stop working for the next 2+ weeks, then what is that going to do to their own supply chain? And what is it going to do for those products that are deemed essential? So we're talking medical supplies here and other products that Amazon is really prioritizing so they can actually fulfill in a very quick manner. We're talking in a matter of days, not weeks, like the items that I purchased. What then happens there? Because they are a huge force right now. They're a huge player in the space for making sure that the supply chain is kept up in good condition for these essential products. So I think it's very interesting to see how some employees are or were praising Amazon for the announcement of pay increases and bonuses and things of that nature not too long ago. And now they're wanting a little bit more because of this coronavirus, of course. And we can understand the spread of this virus has to be mitigated. It absolutely has to. But at what cost to the company? And by the way, what then, of course, would take place if Amazon completely has to shut down? Who would be the one backfilling the need for the supply chain action for a lot of these essential items? A lot to unpack here, but this is just a number of things that are going on as far as strikes around the U.S. There's things circulating in social media that it's not just going to be New York and Chicago areas, but also, of course, Amazon has distribution facilities in a number of municipalities that similar talks are ongoing.
It's always a difficult time to attempt a strike when you've got 7 million people suddenly looking for work. So I think that is ambitious on their part. One of the things I do want to note, though, and you know, we don't take sides in the whole union, non-union thing or company employee thing, or we try not to at least. But the articles that you read online, and this will kind of play into my story a little bit, isn't it interesting how they never seem to interview those that are happy to have a job? And you know, when we talk to retailers throughout the country, when we talk to retail employees throughout the country, many of them are just thankful to stay in work. And many of them, in fact, are looking forward to the ability to help out their communities. They're not as fearful of the disease as much as fearful of making sure their community doesn't go without certain products. So I think that's the other side of the story that rarely, if ever, gets told in media, certainly retail media that we're seeing nowadays surrounding these particular strikes. Well, my story harkens back to last week because remember we said last week that we're seeing trends change very rapidly. It is literally a day-to-day basis. Trends for paper products and people buying paper products are no longer super high because you can't get paper products in stores now. So people have moved on to the next thing. So last week it was dog food. This week, something interesting started to happen wherein a number of state governors, mine included here in Colorado, recommended the use of fabric masks or some sort of face covering when you go out into public. What this did, and maybe an unintended consequence of this, is cause the demand for fabric to go up. So naturally, my first thought was, well, on the retail front, who stands to be able to fulfill these requests? Walmart is one of the largest sellers of fabric in the United States. They're the lone general merchandise retailer that really still has bolts and bolts of fabric around. But you look at other companies like Joann Fabrics, for example, and Joann's, just like Hobby Lobby, who we mentioned last week, has come under scrutiny a little bit for lobbying the fact that they're essential retail. Unlike Hobby Lobby, though, they've been offering free masks as well as fabric to make masks for a lengthy period of time. And in most markets, Joann's stores are still open. Now, of course, this always results in scrutiny. Anytime you're open nowadays as a retailer, you face scrutiny from people who feel like you should be closed and paying your employees. And there was a BuzzFeed article citing four different Joann employees saying that basically they felt like the store should be closed, saying that these masks that were being given out at Joann stores were from fabric taken from the clearance rack. And my response to this is, what does it matter that those masks are taken from the clearance rack? If you're looking for a mask, looking for fabric, you probably don't care a whole lot what type of fabric it is, as long as it meets the requirements. So there's a certain thread count requirement, or suggested requirement at least, and all of these masks do meet that requirement. This is just like someone complaining that a bakery uses day-old bread to make bread pudding. Like, that's what you do in a bakery. That's what you do to make sure things don't go to waste and you don't throw things out. But again, I think it's interesting because they didn't talk to any of the Joann employees that were thankful to still have a job, because I think a lot of news outlets, and BuzzFeed is certainly one of them, you know, a year ago, BuzzFeed's producing these articles about retail dying and no one has any money in retail and retail stores are losing money hand over fist. And now they're producing articles that where they talk to one or two disgruntled employees and these employees feel like they shouldn't have to go to work. And then they're producing articles about how these employees that aren't working should also be paid. But they don't say where the money is supposed to be coming from. So if a year ago you were publishing articles that say that companies like Joann didn't have any money because of some retail apocalypse, then where do you expect the money to come from to pay workers? Because it's not coming from any insurance that the company has. So I think it's this weird duplicity that we're seeing. But the reason I'm looking ahead to it is this. Does this sudden turn towards masks rejuvenate any type of effort from the likes of Hobby Lobby, who we talked about last week, from the likes of Joann, who we're talking about this week, from the likes of other craft stores to stay open in the United States? How does that affect overall sales? And if they can't stay open, this just basically gives all the fabric sales to Walmart. So again, you see yet another interesting category for Walmart. They mentioned popsicle sticks last week, but this week, you know, maybe fabric is up for them. Another category to look out for in terms of fulfillment. And I doubt that Walmart was thinking this far ahead a month or two ago when they're out buying fabric and making buys for fabric. So I think all of it is a very interesting dynamic and worth keeping an eye on going forward. Do the masks things take off? How long does fabric stay in demand? Does fabric remain in demand? Do people start turning to maybe other outlets to get their fabric? Because fabric right now, as Leighton mentioned, you know, it's not seen as a high essential item for Amazon. So you're waiting a long period of time if you're getting it from an online outlet. So a lot to look for in that particular thing. But I'm also looking towards what's going to be the big thing this next week. What are people going to turn to this next week as far as retail fulfillment is concerned? Well, that'll do it for us here on the podcast. Once again, a big thanks to Dan Hirsch, the co-founder of Arizona-based Data Owl, for joining us on the podcast. Also, As a reminder, look ahead to our next podcast where we'll be talking to an actual manager of a dispensary about how not only they're using some of those products, but what they're seeing as far as demand up and around coronavirus and COVID-19 and these times of essentially stay-at-home orders. A big thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll be back again 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.